Please go ahead. This afternoon's conference call is now being recorded.
Thank you very much, Tim. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the PPFAI call on the 29th of April 2014. On the call today, we have Sarah Wild, Steve Metalich, Michaela Nalan, Laura Jadid, Christian Dawson, Don Moody, Darcy Sutherwell, Tim Ruiz, Luke Sosa, Justin Macy, Libby Bainey, Kathy Kleiman, Griffin Barnett, James Bedell, David Heasley, Graham Bunton, and Alice Deacon. We have apologies from Gemma Campias and Osvaldo Novoa. From staff, we have Marika Koenigs, Mary Wong, Amy Bivens, and myself, Natalie Pergin. I'd like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you, Steve.
Thank you very much. This is Steve Metalich, and I'm sitting in his chair today for Don Blumenthal, who was unable to make the call today. He will be back with us next week, though. We have an agenda that was circulated. I think you'll see it on the upper right-hand part of your screen if you're in the Adobe chat room. Anyway, it's a fairly simple agenda. We've had the roll call. Does anybody have any updates that they need to make to their statements of interest? Okay, hearing none, we'll check off agenda item one. That's great. Okay, agenda item two, finalization of preliminary conclusions for category B, question three. You should see in the main part of your screen the revised template that the staff has prepared on this question, which is about rights and responsibilities, and in particular, including in the transfer, renewal, and expiration area. If you scroll down, and I think you can control your screen there, you'll see in the last couple of pages the edits that have been made to the earlier version of the template. And I think they basically recommend some mandatory requirements for accreditation as far as relaying to customers any notices required under the RAA or an ICANN consensus policy, and clearly stating customers' rights and responsibilities and the terms under which service may be terminated. And then there are a couple of best practices recommended regarding facilitating transfer, renewal, or restoration, and using commercially reasonable efforts to avoid the need to disclose underlying customer data in the process of renewing, transferring, or restoring a domain name. So I think that this was the staff's effort to try to summarize and synthesize a lot of discussion that we've had on the last call or two and a little bit on the list as well. Let me just ask if people have comments or questions on this template for B3 or whether we're prepared to accept it as the preliminary conclusion. I don't see any hands up, but I see Kathy in the chat asking about the timeline for the subgroup on the technical subgroup. I guess the question, that is a point that we discussed last time, whether there should be a separate subgroup to look in detail at what the policies ought to be with regard to transfer and renewal. But I think that's a question we need to decide, whether we want to have that subgroup working or whether we're reasonably comfortable with these conclusions as they've been spelled out in the document. Kathy has her hand up, so Kathy, please go.
Hi, I'm on the phone now. Good morning, Steve. Good morning, everyone. I think it was my understanding at the end of last meeting that we had agreed on the subgroup and that there seemed to be, you know, some wide support across all types of users for a subgroup that would look at the technical details of the transfer, because questions had been raised and we were descending into pretty technical ground involving transfer policy and issues that seemed to go beyond kind of the scope that we wanted to deal with on the main calls. So I thought there had been agreement to go into a subgroup to look at more technical details and then to bring back the results for consideration by the larger group.
Okay. James is next on this topic. James, go ahead.
Thanks, Steve. James speaking for the record. And I think, and I guess I'm not sure, Kathy. I don't remember my, I mean, you may be right. I just, my memory's not really that great on last week or even yesterday in some respects. But, you know, I'm just thinking about this a little bit more. I think that there's no question that there is a desire to look at this issue of whether transfers can occur between accredited privacy providers without exposing that data. I think that, however, I would caution that any subgroup's work not be sufficient, you know, overly detailed for two reasons. I think it should limit itself to just sort of general principles or ideas, because I think that there are a lot of ways to approach this, and I don't think that the subgroup should be out inventing products or even, you know, patentable inventions, because this is new to world as far as I know. And secondly, I think that that would also be very restrictive in these services and their ability to improve or enhance these functions in the future if they're they're baked into policy at a detailed level. So while I don't remember where we left it last week, I do wish to express that we should be as generic as possible, stick to high-level principles, and not get into the technical details of how these services actually work. That's just my opinion. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, James. So I think we've heard two somewhat contrasting versions of what this subgroup might be chartered to do. I don't think we'd reached a definite, my sense is, or my recollection is, we hadn't reached a definite conclusion, but there had obviously been some discussion about having this subgroup. And I guess I'd be interested in Kathy's response, and I guess she has her hand up to make the response. So, Kathy, go ahead.
Great. Thanks, Steve. For some reason, I do remember the discussion. So, and in part because of the unusual group of people that came around to support it. And I also remember it was a kind of do-it-at-your-own-risk, that there was no, based on some of the concerns that have been raised by James and others, that there was no requirement that the larger working group act on whatever comes back from the subgroup, but it was more informational. There seemed to be some strange hurdles of perhaps some weird wording in rules that had been written before proxy privacy services were around, perhaps, that there might be some things that the subgroup could explore, help everyone understand, to kind of make it easier for proxy privacy transfers to take place without disclosing the underlying data, which seemed to be a goal we all wanted, but how to get there was what the subgroup was going to look at. And again, it was very much a do-it-at-your-own-risk, spend-your-time-at-your-own-risk kind of thing, but there did seem to be some wide support for it.
Okay, thank you, Kathy.
Thanks,
Marika, I think you're next.
So this is Marika. To be honest, I also recall some people having, you know, concern or cautioning against sending off a sub team to look at this question, I think probably for a couple of reasons. First of all, that in order to do so, I think a question would be specifically need to be defined what the sub team would actually be looking at, and also noting that, you know, there is an inter-registrar transfer policy already in place, which has, you know, a separate working group also looking at the, you know, other questions in relation to the transfer policy. So I'm not even sure if it would be within scope for this working group to actually come up with changes to that policy. So, again, I think it would need a bit more framing before, you know, sending off a group and indeed spending time and on something that, I think Kathy says that, you know, the working group may not do anything with, but I think it may be more useful to actually try to define what it would be doing and to come up with something that would be actionable. And again, it may also be a question that is put forward for a possible future transfer working group to look at if it's really going in the direction of making changes to the transfer policy itself instead of providing more general guidance on, you know, doing everything possible to allow registrants to transfer domain name registrations between registrars, maintaining the proxy or privacy details. So again, I think we raised it last time as well. I think we kind of saying no more IRTPs, but again, I think it requires a bit more framing to make sure that everyone's aware of what the subteam would be looking at, also for the subteam itself to know what their scope and remit is, and what the expectation of the working group are for them to come back with recommendations.
Okay. Thank you, Marika. I mean, James expressed some concern that this subgroup should only be looking at general principles and not trying to invent a product. And I don't know, Kathy, if you're comfortable with that limitation on it. Obviously, we have some, in the draft now, we have some general principles, which are, the best practices about facilitating and not hindering transfer, renewal, or restoration, and most specifically on the last one, just at the end of the boxes, I guess, on the next to last page, privacy proxy services should use commercially reasonable efforts to avoid the need to disclose underlying customer data in the process of renewing, transferring, or restoring a domain name. So I don't know if it's helpful in terms of defining what this subgroup would do, but is it... could characterize it as trying to provide some more detail or some more information on what the commercially reasonable efforts that were referred to in that bullet might include. I don't know if that's useful or a diversion from what the volunteers for this subgroup want, but I thought I would put on the table that that's one way we might approach it. I see Kathy, then Tim, and then James. So, Kathy, please go ahead.
Okay. I wish we had the chat of the last session, because there did seem to be a number of people chiming in. I know Paul McGrady did, as well as others. No one's trying to reopen the IRTP. I thought the purpose of the subgroup was really to look at whatever hurdles, purposeful or inadvertent, were there in the proxy privacy transfer that we could clear together. So I agree with what's been written into the summary materials, and I think it's really very important progress. But I thought we were, in light of some of the very technical questions that Mary had kept posing in front of us, and that some of these questions, I remember particularly 2 and 3 didn't seem to have, I don't have them in front of me, these questions that Mary kept posing that had to do with the IRTP policy and interpretation. And there seemed to be some ambiguities or some vagaries, and there was a thought that the subgroup could help the working group move forward with some real questions, with some real answers to the types of questions that were being posed. But it was much too technical, I think, for most of us to do. But it seemed to have a lot of relevance to not disclosing customers, proxy privacy customers, in the transfer. And there seemed to be some fairly low-hanging fruit there that it wasn't that difficult, but a few people had to kind of dive into it a little bit. So this could be a subgroup for a short period of time with a very limited mandate. That's my sense. And I'm going to go back and try to dig out the questions that Mary posed. And again, it was the third and fourth ones that seemed to kind of lead us to the subgroup area. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Kathy. Tim?
I think my concern about the working group is that one, that it spends a lot of time doing what we thought we'd ultimately agreed. Well, first of all, I thought what we ultimately agreed was that that not necessarily making the non-revealing, that you had to make it possible to not reveal data in a transfer, that we might recommend that as a potential best practice, that it might be, something that you should consider implementing, but not necessarily requiring all services to implement it. And then customers can make a choice based on the various services that different proxy and privacy providers offer. So I think that's where we were at. So I guess my concern about the working group was that they spent a lot of time on something that we're not going to actually make, you know, as a requirement or even recommend that it be a requirement for all providers to offer. So that would be my first concern. The second one would be that if we do form a working group for this purpose for any reason, that it very clearly be specified that they're not to look at any modifications to the transfer policy in any way, that what they're looking at is, you know, what can be done without modifying the transfer policy, and that would be their primary focus. So it seems like since we've got in, you know, the conclusions we have in here regarding this subject seem to kind of cover it, and to go into any more detail at this point, you know, unless later we feel that there's a need to be more specific or to direct, you know, providers to have to, you know, provide this service as a requirement, I don't see the point in the working group right now. So I don't recall what all we discussed. I might have even supported the working group last week. I don't know. But just looking at the conclusion we have right now and the discussion we've had so far today, I guess I don't really see the point of it.
Okay, thanks, Tim. Mary has posted some excerpts from last week's chat in the this week's chat, so that's available as a resource. James, I think you were next in the queue. Please identify yourself.
Thanks, Steve. James speaking, and I just want to support both a lot of what Tim and Kathy have been saying. I think, you know, one way forward would be to convene the group, but, you know, as Kathy was saying, rather than solving the problem, maybe identify those hurdles and suggest some ways that service providers can coordinate without rewriting the policy or creating new obligations. I think that might be a sensible way forward, you know, out of this issue. But I think, you know, going back to what Tim was saying, I think that it would be key perhaps to have a group that would discuss a way to coordinate between privacy and proxy service providers in such a way that does not touch the registrar obligations under the IRTP, and that the IRTP is considered essentially, you know, out of bounds or out of scope for that working group. So that's just one thought on how we can maybe navigate a path forward. I think it is my recollection from last week is everyone agreed that this was a desirable trait. I think that how to achieve it and how much of it should be required versus how much of it should be a best practice or a value-added service offering, I think was where the group started to fragment a little bit. So that's I'll drop for now, but I think that's one approach we could take.
Okay, looking in the chat, Kathy seems to be agreeing with what James is saying. I think everyone's in agreement that this group would not have any authority to propose changes to the transfer policies, the IRTP. And I think there's agreement on identifying hurdles, suggesting how service providers can coordinate. Let me just ask if anybody else has any oral comments they want to make at this point about a possible subgroup. And if not, I guess my suggestion would be maybe Kathy and James could go offline in the next few days and come up with a very brief summary, you know, mission statement or description of what this subgroup would be about and suggest a timetable for it to report back. I think there is general agreement conceptually between Kathy and James on what this would be doing, but I think it's clearly we should have something down in writing, which I don't think needs to be more than a sentence or two, really, as to what the subgroup would do and what would be a reasonable time frame for it to come back, report back to this group, which could then decide, you know, what to do with that output. I mean, it, as Kathy indicated, there's no guarantee that this group would take that up, but I think if some smart people could spend a little time thinking about this and learning about this, I think we could probably benefit from that. Is anybody? I don't see a disagreement with that. I don't know if I said charter, but I won't say it. So I think mission statement or parameters is better. So if there's no objection, then we'll ask Kathy and James to formulate something and hopefully get it out on the list so we can all look at it prior to next week's call, and hopefully just at that point just say, fine, that sounds great. Let's line up make sure all our volunteers are still committed, and have that group get started, subgroup get started. And the other thing, let me just again refer back to what's on your screen, the B3 preliminary conclusions. Are people comfortable with these? Again, subject to whatever the group might come back with, but is there any objection from those on the call to this language that the staff has prepared on B3? Okay, not hearing any objection, then I think what we can do is move on to Category C, and the staff will, of course, put this out again on the list and say we reached this tentative preliminary conclusion on B3 and make sure everybody has that, knows what that is. Our Kathy and James will come back to us with a mission statement for a subgroup seamless transfer, whatever you want to call, whatever label you want to put on the ability to transfer without disclosing the underlying customer data. And if there's no further comments on B3 at this moment, why don't we move on to C? And you will see on your screen on the right-hand side, as Kathy pointed out, there's a threshold question for Category C, which I think could well be helpful it could certainly facilitate our getting to preliminary conclusions on the sub questions in C. So let me ask that we turn to that first, and just to read it, currently proxy privacy services are available to companies, non-commercial organizations, and individuals. Should there be any change to this aspect of the current system in the new accreditation standards? I think that's kind of, as Kathy put it, the threshold question to C1 and C2, certainly, which you're asking, should it be available to commercial registrants? Should it be only available to individuals? Kind of asking two versions of the same question. So let me open the floor for comments or proposed responses to this threshold question about whether there should be anything in the accreditation standards that changes the status quo in which all types of registrants are using proxy/privacy services. See, Kathy has a comment. Anybody else? Kathy, why don't you go ahead?
Sorry, I feel like I'm taking way too much floor space, mic space this morning. But I remember we talked at length about this threshold question as one that might save us time before we go into more specific questions of what classes and what categories. Is should there be any change at all? And so I'm sure it won't surprise you to hear that my view is that we shouldn't have any change, that right now in the GTLDs, proxy privacy services, are available if the proxy privacy service provider wants to provide them this way to companies, non-commercial organizations, and individuals. And as we've discussed, as I believe is now in the process of being codified into the last summary that we just approved or in the process of approving, proxy privacy service in and of itself is not a sign of anything. It's a sign that people want privacy, that organizations, human rights groups want privacy. It's not a sign of anything negative at all. And so I think all of these groups, it was a finding of the WHOIS review team, actually, after talking with all the stakeholder groups, that every user group that we talked with had very legitimate needs and uses of proxy privacy services. So companies use it so that they can avoid announcing a new product or service beforehand. You register the domain name and then go back to your PR team and develop, you know, the plan to unveil whatever the product or service is. And that can take, you know, several months, if not longer. Non-commercial organizations, obviously, you've heard a lot about personal speech, political speech, and the concern that that not be tracked directly to your home address if you're a small group. And, of course, individuals and their freedom of expression rights and a lot of things they're trying to communicate, as well as small businesses, entrepreneurs that are working from home. So we found that all sorts of groups use proxy privacy services. So as a threshold question, as a threshold issue, supporting that going forward seems to make a lot of sense. So thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. James?
Hi, thanks, James speaking. And no, Kathy, you're not dominating the conversation because I'm at least 40% of it at this point. But not surprisingly, I agree with Kathy. I think that we were both on the WHOIS review team. We remember that this question was examined fairly thoroughly within that group and was determined that there were a number of legitimate needs or use cases for commercial or non-commercial entities to use these services. I think that where we might have gotten confused, and I'm going to just throw this out here, is that I think that in some jurisdictions only natural persons have a right to privacy, and I think somehow that has been transformed into only natural persons are eligible for privacy. And I think that that's maybe where we went off track, because certainly the need and the desire and the legitimate purposes for privacy of businesses and human rights groups, et cetera, are within bounds. And I think that we should leave the status quo intact. And I think that there should be a fairly high bar for any proposals that would change the status quo or limit the ability for folks who currently use these services to no longer have access to them.
Okay, thank you, James. Kieran is next.
Hi, and I apologize. I'm really very ill today, so I don't know if anyone will be able to understand me through my fog. But not surprisingly, I don't think we've been secret about this desire at Mark Monitor to address this question about the legitimacy of privacy proxy use for commercial registrants. I think that it is correct, obviously, that the WHOIS review team did identify several legitimate uses for businesses and commercial users to avail themselves of privacy proxy. But I think that, especially with Kathy's example, companies can and commercial entities can keep an initial registration secret, but as soon as they start, as soon as they launch a website with commercial purposes, then, you know, they, generally we would encourage them to flip over to a live and accurate WHOIS information. But the concept that we kind of hang our hat on in this is that most of the laws that discuss commercial transactions in the brick-and-mortar world allow us to always know who we're doing business with. So we think that the same right to understand the same kind of consumer protection that represents should be present in the digital world as well as in the brick-and-mortar world, I guess. Let's just use that again. So we also believe that, you know, this at least merits discussion. I don't think that it's a simple question. I don't think it's an easy question, but as long as we're talking thresholds here, I think it's very, very important for us to discuss this as a group in more depth. And also, I do recall that the privacy proxy abuse study that came out, I guess it was last year, was actually did demonstrate that there are a number of people that are using these services to abuse consumers for a number of reasons, for counterfeit products, for, intellectual property infringement, for, counterfeit pharmaceuticals and safety. We see that all the time at Mark Monitor. So I think it's kind of unfair to just assume that everybody who's using them for commercial purposes, these services for commercial purposes, is on the up and up. So that's our position in kind of a very not eloquent way, but I do believe that this conversation should not be dismissed and this question should not be swept under the rug.
Okay. Thank you, Kieran. I see Tim and Volker in the queue. Is there anybody else that wants to speak at this point? Tim, go ahead. Okay, I see Kathy. We'll put you at the end of the queue. Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, Tim Ruiz. I think it's also important, though, that we don't assume that everybody who uses proxy and privacy services are criminals. The vast majority, I would stipulate, are probably not. And that was one of the things I think I asked a while back. I don't think we ever saw is just a better understanding of the statistics because a lot of people tout that around about, there's a significant number that use privacy proxy services for, untoward activities or whatever, but we've never seen any very good statistics around all that. So that might be interesting to see if we're really going to get into this discussion. But I think that, comparing this to the brick and mortar world, I think that it's perfectly legitimate to say that, a commercial business, you should know who you're doing business with. But I don't think the who is the way that that's going to get done. Your average consumer doesn't look at who is. They look at the website, and they try to find out on the website. I mean, I do that myself, and I've been in the ICANN policy stuff for decades, over a decade. But when I am at a website doing business with somebody, I look at, contact me, about, there's a lot of different things I look at to try to figure out who these people are and whether I want to do business with them. So I think that, your average consumer isn't going to look at who is. And even those of us probably don't use who is that much to try to figure out who we're doing business with online. So if there are to be, legislation or rules or policies or laws about making sure that consumers know who they're doing business with, I think they ought to apply at a different level than at the who is level. And I don't think that the level they should apply at is under our purview or even under ICANN's purview. And so as far as who is concerned, I think there's, perfectly legitimate reasons why any party may want to use privacy for a period of time or for an extended period of time. And I would submit that if there are going to be differences in how we treat different categories, if you want to call it that, of users, that we might want to look at that more under the reveal area and not under who gets to use the service. So that'd be my take on it.
Okay, thank you. I've put myself in the queue after Kathy, but we have Volker, I think, was next. Volker, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Steve. Thank you, Steve. Tim is exactly right. The website is where the people are doing business, not the domain name itself. The domain name is just how they reach the website. And if people want to know who they're doing business with, going to the brick-and-mortar world comparison, that information should be on the website. And the European countries have gone ahead and legislated that. You have to have an imprint on each website that's doing some form of business online, and if they don't have that, you can sue them, or you can force them to put that on there, and you can report them to the local authorities. And frankly, I wouldn't do business with someone who doesn't put their address into the phone number on their website as a business. So the website is where this information should be. Overloading the Whoist with things that you want to achieve with the Whoist that it wasn't designed for, I think it leads down the wrong path.
Thank you, Volker. Kathy? Kathy, did you on mute, or did you want to speak? She's typing, so perhaps we've lost the audio there. Okay, we'll move forward, and we'll come back to Kathy. I put myself in the queue here because I do agree with some of what Tim and Volker have been saying, but not with all of it. It's true that some countries have requirements to disclose commercial, you know, the contact information on commercial actors on the website. Some countries don't have that. Some countries enforce those rules more stringently than others. And I think Whois does have a role to play in letting people know who they are dealing with online. I don't think it's overloading Whois to, or any distortion of the original purpose of Whois, to say that that's part of what Whois is about, and that's one means that people can, should be able to use to find out who they're dealing with online, including, but not limited to, commercial actors. That being said, I think there are a lot of practical problems with treating, you know, with saying that only commercial users can't use proxy services, and I don't really know a way to surmount those practical problems. And I would also agree with Tim that one aspect of this is very important: is what are the reveal rules? What are the circumstances under which a commercial operator, let's say, who does choose to use a privacy or proxy service, can be unmasked or at least disclosed to a particular user based on the way that entity or that person is using the domain name. So I think that's probably a more practical way to approach this, because I do see some significant practical problems with a requirement that to exclude commercial users from these services. I also just want to emphasize that we're talking about minimum standards here, accreditation standards, and I don't think there's any problem with a proxy service deciding that it will not make its services available to commercial users and using whatever tests it wishes to propose in order to do that. I think that's perfectly legitimate, and I don't think we're talking about requiring all services to be equally open to commercial or non-commercial users. We're talking about whether this would be a minimum requirement. So I just wanted to make those points. Let me turn back to the queue. We have James, and then Kieran, Kathy, and Justin. James, go ahead.
Thanks, Steve. James, for the record, do you want to see if Kathy's ready now, or as I can hold for her?
Nope. Kathy,
since she had audio problems.
Still on hold, she says. Okay, so
okay.
James, go
ahead. Steve, I can get behind a lot of what you were saying there just a moment ago. I wanted to take a more practical approach to this. Let's play this out for a minute here. Suppose that we did determine as a group that commercial users and commercial activities would be disallowed under this under accredited privacy proxy services. Well, I think the first question would be, what happens to the ones who have it now? And I think that the Debut study pointed out that several major banks and stock traders, and brokerage firms and financial services all use these services. So I think we would have to determine how we would gently or in an organized way remove privacy service from those existing users. I think the second bit would be when does one cross the line and become a commercial user? Is it an individual who is selling something as an individual or a sole trader, or is it only for non-natural, legal entities? Even if they're not conducting any transactions, are they kicked out? And I think, that opens another interesting idea, which is that, what's to prevent someone from just lying? I mean, I can be taken in by a con artist or a fake pharmacy or whatever by an individual just as easily as a business. So I'm not really clear in a practical term, what we're talking about, particularly if we're saying that if it's just a transaction-based differentiator, that, as soon as you exchange money over a website, or I guess since we're talking domain names, it wouldn't have to be a website. It could be email or any other services, or an app, for example, that uses the domain name, would constitute a commercial transaction. And would that also include things like donations to political or religious groups? Would that be considered a commercial transaction? So I guess, I just building on what you were thinking, Don, is that if we play this out, the practical implications of this are astounding, and I think it creates for the first time, an ICANN perspective that, not all registrants are equal, that there are classes of registrants, which is something new. I think we see it in some country codes, but it would be new in GTLDs. So I think that this is something that we would have to consider as part of any examination of this question or any recommendations that would come out of it. And I think ultimately the harms that we would be trying to mitigate or the benefits we'd be trying to achieve would be lost in all of the misses and the false positives of pursuing this path. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, James. I have Kieran, Kathy, and Justin, and is there anybody else that wanted to be in the queue at this point? If not, Kieran, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to add quickly, there was some discussion earlier about the value of who is information and whether or not we can just rely on in-website, contact information for businesses. I would say, as a product security firm, we rely almost entirely, I would gather to say, on Whois, and inaccurate Whois is a huge burden, particularly in our more urgent cases that deal with, safety products and as well as our anti-fraud services, which would deal with websites that are perpetuating, malware, phishing, those kinds of things. So Whois information is extremely, extremely important for those of us who are actually actively pursuing the kind of action against these registrants. I would also say that the issues that James just brought up are very consequential and extremely complicated. And that's why I think that it is a very, very bad idea for us to just say, oh, no, this is too complicated, let's move on. So, frankly, I think that these are the issues for privacy and proxy services, especially from a consumer protection perspective, which is where we're coming from. So I thank James for kind of listing all of those issues, but I would disagree that, as a result of understanding all of the complications that exist in relation to this question, we draw a foregone conclusion that it's just too difficult for us to deal with or, whatever. We shouldn't be drawing any conclusions at this stage. We should, in my opinion, we should just be asking the questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Kieran. I have Kathy and then Justin. Anybody else that wants to be in the queue at this point? If not, we will. I see Tim has gotten back in. We'll cut it off after Tim because we're getting toward the top of the hour here. So, Kathy, please go ahead.
I'm happy to be back online. Sorry for dropping everyone. Okay, just different things that I've heard in the discussion. I agree with a lot of what's being said by Tim, by James. There are a lot of practical implications here, but a few things kind of as premises, and also to begin to illustrate what kind of time we we might get involved in as we go into some very, very, very difficult and ambiguous and inconsistent areas of law. First, trading companies. The companies that have to do the disclosures, as I understand it, and as Volker was, I think it was Volker who was outlining it, are commercial companies trading online. The vast majority, at least when the WHOIS review team looked at that, the vast majority of transactions in the commercial world are business to business, and there are not disclosure requirements on that. In fact, when I deal as an expert attorney and an internet attorney with certain law firms, they don't know where I'm operating from until they send the check. It's not a requirement, even if I have a website that's sharing information. I'm not providing information to end users, to end customers. I'm not selling a service to the public. I'm selling a service to a business. And in business-to-business transactions, disclosure is by contract. And so those companies wouldn't have an obligation. But then we begin to descend into the whole rat hole. And sorry to use that word, but the amount of time we could spend on this is forever, which is what is a commercial entity and what do we really mean by commercial entity? In the United States, charitable organizations that have tax-exempt status of 501c3, which is a very valuable status, by definition have to be incorporated. So they're commercial entities for the purpose of being nonprofits and getting that special status with the Internal Revenue Service of the United States. So many, 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 in fact, almost all churches, at least in the United States, churches, synagogues, mosques, human rights groups, Planned Parenthood clinics are incorporated because that's how you create entities. It doesn't mean that they're trading to the public. It doesn't mean that they're necessarily in the scope of what we would ever want to, you know, when they're not selling shoes, but they have, for the purpose of getting insurance, for the purpose of protecting their board of directors, they are incorporated, and we use that for both profit and nonprofit entities. So to begin to descend into differentiating all of this, again, I deeply fear we could be here forever, and that it very much includes entities that we don't want to grab within the scope of, you know, that are otherwise entitled, that we've talked about as being entitled to proxy privacy services. So I like the idea of beginning to explore some of this under reveal, but not creating categories and classes now and not spending the amount of time it would take to begin to even peel the onion of categories and classes. Thank you very much. Sorry for the long discussion.
Thanks, Kathy. Justin?
Hi, I'm Justin Macy from LegisScript. I think I agree with Karen in the idea that this is definitely worth the time for us to discuss this. I think this is probably one of the most important discussions that this group can have. And I think it's dangerous if we punt this issue to the reveal area of our discussion, because quite frankly, most people who are going to use this can't request a reveal on all of these individuals in the cybersecurity area and that kind of stuff. And further, we kind of point out some red herrings of issues along the way, like individual actors not using WHOIS or parents not knowing what WHOIS is. But the reality is law enforcement agencies and other agencies protect people using this information. So even if they don't know what WHOIS is, it doesn't mean they're not getting a benefit from that WHOIS information being public. I think that James pointed out a lot of just categorically hard questions, and I think that those questions are things that we should absolutely discuss. Also, there's a distinction being made about corporate entities, or especially like Kathy just now regarding incorporations of churches and whatnot. There's definitely different ways we can parse this definition. One of them, of course, is commercial entities. The other is commercial actors, people who are acting in commerce, rather than just people who are registered as commercial entity. And I think that there are ways we can tackle that as well. So I just wanted to throw my support in for Karen and suggest that this is definitely an issue we should look further into.
Okay, thank you, Justin. Tim, briefly, your contribution.
Yeah, I guess I see this getting more complicated even just as we talk. I mean, Karen's saying, well, registered commercial entities, and then Justin just said, oh, well, there's acting commercial, you know, I'm not even sure what that's supposed to mean. At any rate, I think, you know, if we underestimate the amount of time we could end up going down this rat hole, as Kathy put it, I mean, we are seriously negligent of our duties here. And I think if we need to go down that rat hole, then that's great. But before we do it, because it'll be all the rest of the time we're going to spend, we'll be on that easily. But before we go there, to me, the question we should ask first is what do we want to get out of it? I mean, and that's what's missing out of this, you know, category C question one question is what, why? What do we want to get out of it? What's the purpose? What's the problem? What are we trying to solve? Let's figure that out first, because we may find that we don't have to go down that rat hole to solve it, that we can actually solve it another way through the reveal discussion or whatever, or we may decide, well, let's see if we can solve this through the reveal discussion, and then if we can't, we can go down that rat hole. But just to assume now, let's go into this great big complicated discussion about what's a commercial entity, what is it, how do we how would it be enforced, and all the complications that we would throw on something like that, I think is a mistake. First, let's look at what is it we want to get out of it and go from there.
Okay. Thank you, Tim. This is Steve. I'm going to wrap up this discussion. I think we've gotten this off to a good start. My sense of this is kind of what you would expect by looking at the responses on C1. I think there is that probably most of the participants think the answer to this threshold question should be no, there shouldn't be a change, but I think we also have a vocal group that feels that there should be. I think we have to be careful in this discussion. Even just looking in the chat, I think things have gotten a bit vituperative over there. But even in the oral discussion, let's try to be careful about both our rhetoric of rat holes and other paths that we're going down, and also just on our concepts, because it's very easy to confuse the corporate form of organization of an entity with commercial, and they're absolutely not the same thing, and it is, I think, extremely unhelpful to conflate them, which unfortunately I think some of the comments we've heard today have done. I think we're going to have to return to this next week, and I think my suggestion, but I hope we can have some more discussion during the week, is we don't have consensus on the threshold question. Maybe we need to turn to C1, whether the accredited provider should distinguish between commercial and personal purposes. And I think that means that we, those who think that they should be proposing some practical or answering some of the practical questions that have come up about how that would be done. But I don't want to I don't think we have a consensus on that question yet, but perhaps as we get into some of the more practical issues, it will help to illuminate it. That's my two cents worth on this. So let me ask that we put this aside and go on to our final topic, which is next steps. Well, we've talked about next steps and planning for London. Mary, could you fill us in on what it is we need to do or decide about London at this point?
Yes, of course, Steve. Hi, everybody. This is Mary. So I think as many of us know, there may be some changes to the usual meeting schedule for London. The one that will most specifically affect this working group is the proposed change to the Thursday schedule. We've had the last couple of face-to-face meetings, including remote participation for this group, on a Thursday morning. So this will mean that should this group wish to have a face-to-face meeting, we'll need to find some other slot for it. After discussing it with the chairs, the feeling was that it would be beneficial to continue to have those meetings at the ICANN meetings. So what we're proposing is to put in a request for the Wednesday morning, of course, on the understanding that we don't yet know what other big-ticket items or changes might be, but just generally that it is a lot better to put in a request and have it on the schedule and maybe try to move it around or even cancel it than to try and get in a last-minute request. Steve, I see Volker's got his hand raised, and I think it may be because he's planning the GNSO schedule. So I'll defer to Volker.
Volker, is it on the GNSO schedule? go ahead.
Yes, exactly. Thank you, Mary, and thank you, Steve. Just one quick question. We're trying to streamline the council session a bit, and I would just like to ask the group if we think that we need some time to present, and if not, to make that known to, me, by the next meeting that we have next week, so we can either include or exclude this group from the presentation to the council. If we don't have any reports and nothing to ask the council, then it might be good to just skip that meeting and have no report if there's nothing substantive to report.
So, Volker, you're referring to just a status report. Do we need a status report to the council on the weekend preceding?
Exactly.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm not quite sure where we'll be at that point, but I agree with you. We don't need to report just for the sake of reporting, unless we have some issue we need the council to address. But let's think about that during the week, and hopefully get you an answer on that by next week. Okay. Are there any other comments on the London meeting? Okay, I see there have been some discussion in the chat about remaining on the threshold question. This may be a distinction without a difference, but I think it'd be useful to move ahead and sort of get to some of these practical issues and see how serious they are. As I mentioned in my first intervention here, I think there are some very serious practical issues if you were going to distinguish between commercial or non-commercial, individual or corporate, entities and their eligibility for these services. So I think perhaps if we get our toe wet on that, we would get a better sense of how serious those problems are. Are they something that we can work through, or are they something that really is kind of a showstopper? So that's just my feeling on this. Other Volker, that's an old hand, I trust?
Yes, sure. Sorry.
Okay. Well, thanks, everyone. We've reached the top of the hour. I appreciate everybody's contribution today. Don will be back in the chair next week, and we will all talk again then. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Tim. You